Thank you very much. It was a real pleasure to get this invitation to come and speak today. And it's both a great opportunity, but also a bit of a challenge, like Elizabeth, to have somewhat different topic to bring to you. What I'll be talking about is largely, because of my own background, a geochemical focus on the issue of contamination in groundwater. But where I'll end with this is really where this field is going, which is to try and integrate the geochemical aspect or approach that we take, and that I'll be talking about mostly today, with some of our colleagues in hydrogeology who really then take this kind of information and integrate it into reactive transport models of groundwater flow. So the interface with mathematics and with the computational sciences is really the direction that this particular field is headed. But what I'll talk to you about today is really more of the background behind it, and specifically the focus of the work that we do here at the University of Toronto, which is largely, as I said, geochemical in focus, and particularly focusing on compound-specific isotope analysis, because what our lab is an isotope geochemistry lab. What I'll be looking at is the work that we're doing tracking the fate and then the sources of hydrocarbon contamination in groundwater systems. There we go. So our laboratory is located in the Department of Geology, just a stone's throw on the other side here. I was regretting that this is the first time I've actually come into the Institute, so I should issue the invitation in the other direction. If anybody ever wants to come over and actually see the instruments that drive this whole research process, please, I'll stand you to lunch and give you a tour of the lab, since we're such near neighbors. So we are focused mostly in geology, since that's where the lab is, but this is actually a really interdisciplinary work that involves collaboration with both colleagues and graduate students in a wide variety of different departments, including chemistry, at which I have an adjunct appointment, chemical and civil engineering departments as well are highly involved in this work. There's a wide variety of different environmental contaminants out there, as we're all aware from reading the headlines. There are two main groups that we've been focusing on, and part of what I'll do today is to try to give you the rationale for why we've decided to focus much of our research on the petroleum hydrocarbons and chlorinated solvents, and then give you some introduction into what environmental contamination of these compounds looks like in the context of groundwater contamination. And then finally, the bulk of this will focus on the work that we've been doing, which is developing compound-specific stable isotope analysis as a new approach for looking at issues of hydrocarbon contamination in groundwater. So the first and major group of compounds that we look at are the aromatic hydrocarbons. These are benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylene. They're commonly known as the BTEX compounds, and they constitute up to about 30% of gasoline. And as I always say when I go to my son's grade 4 class and talk about a little bit about this stuff, you know when you go to the gas station and your mother says, don't smell that stuff, aromatic hydrocarbons, that's exactly what you're smelling, is this particular group of compounds. And the reason she's, you know, mom is always right, it's also the thing I always tell my grade 4 son, you don't want to smell this stuff because no one is suspected carcinogens. And our graduate students, I always tell them that they're going to be exposed to more of this pumping gas at the local gas station than they ever will be doing research in my laboratory, given the use of fume hoods and all the very strict safety standards that we have. But clearly something that's quite pervasive in terms of use in our modern society, it has another couple of interesting characteristics that make it particularly problematic as an environmental contaminant, and that is that these compounds are quite soluble. And because of that, they become very mobile once they're introduced into the environment. They're easily dissolved into groundwater and therefore can be carried and transported in groundwater long distances from the point of the spill. You can imagine the wide variety of different potential sources of this contamination, both from exploration and production, transport through pipelines, trucks, or oil tankers. And in addition, the thing that I always like to point out as well is the number of very local and small-scale potential sources of contamination. Commercial outlets such as your neighborhood gas station, household use, if anybody's ever changed the oil pan on their car and spilled it on the ground, we too are contributing to these sources of contamination in the environment. And one of the major factors is we tend to store this stuff, both at gas stations, particularly in homes that were once heated by oil and gas. We have estimated hundreds of thousands of leaking storage tanks across North America, all of them contributing to leakage of this stuff into the environment. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about the chemical properties of these compounds, but there's one chemical property in particular that's very important in terms of determining where we find these compounds in groundwater systems, and that is the density of these compounds. They are less dense than water, meaning that they're something referred to as an LNAPL, a less dense non-aqueous phase liquid. And that's intuitively obvious to anybody who's ever seen pictures of the Amoco Cadiz or the Exxon Valdez. When this stuff is spilt, obviously because it's less dense than water, it forms an oil slick and floats on the top of any kind of water surface that it meets. The same thing applies when this material is introduced into the groundwater. This is a very simplified schematic meant to represent a typical groundwater system. In this particular one, the surface of the land is indicated in the solid line. What I've tried to represent below here is a very simple hydrogeological system where we have looking at largely in blue sand sediments. Just to introduce some element of reality, I've introduced some clay materials as well in both continuous and discontinuous layers. And this would be quite typical of the types of materials we find here in southern Ontario, so this would not be unrepresentative of the type of aquifer systems we might find here in this part of the province. The dashed line with the two inverted triangles is a common designation for the water table. And roughly, the way of understanding this is the water table is basically that portion of the sediments and subsurface that has all of its pore spaces saturated with water. So groundwater is not in any sense an underground river. What it is simply the saturation of all pore surfaces with water, and then there is interconnection between those pore spaces, and so one can get groundwater flow throughout these systems because of that interconnection between those saturated pore surfaces or pore spaces. So we tend to, as hydrogeologists, represent groundwater flow very simply, one big arrow, but really what you're looking at is a much more dispersed pattern with groundwater flow occurring throughout all of these various systems. So what happens then if we actually get a spill of this material? In this particular case, again, this could represent just about anything, a gas station, a storage tank, an overturned tanker. What happens is that LNAPL, or free product, pure chemical, then spills and penetrates the pore spaces of the unsaturated zone. But the important thing to remember about LNAPLs is that water table acts as somewhat of a limit to the extent of contamination. Just as when an oil tanker spills its load, it forms an oil slick over the surface of the water. Similarly, in the subsurface, that material will tend to hit the water table, and because it is less dense, spread out over top of it. So it means that this type of spill tends to occupy or tends to be relatively close to the surface compared to other types of contaminants that we'll talk about in a few minutes. But of course, that's not the end of the story. That would just show you the distribution of where the oil or gasoline itself has gone. Because you've got groundwater flow coming under here and moving past, and because that material is soluble, the real issue is that the groundwater begins to dissolve away that material and uptakes it, so that you get the formation of a plume of dissolved contamination downstream of the initial spill. So the groundwater then acts as a major mechanism for dispersion of that material further out into the environment. And it's by this mechanism then that we end up with groundwater contamination that may be very far removed from the site of the original spill. The second major compounds that we work a lot on are the chlorinated ethenes. Now, unlike aromatic hydrocarbons, which are formed from oil and gas and therefore are naturally occurring compounds, the chlorinated ethenes are man-made chemicals, solvents in widespread industrial production and use since the 1940s. The first in the series that I'll talk about is perchloroethylene, which is a carbon-based compound. It's a two-carbon compound joined by a double bond, and then it has four, represented in green, chlorines attached to the double carbon bond. And again, this is one you'd be more familiar with than you realize. Anytime you've walked into a dry cleaning store and smelt that sweet smell, that's perchloroethylene. The second major compound that we'll take a look at today is trichloroethylene, and you can see that it's related. In this case, it has simply three chlorines with the fourth position occupied by a hydrogen. Trichloroethylene is one of the major manufacturing solvents and degreasing agents. Any facility that's handled any kind of electronics, computers, global manufacturing, global positioning systems, gasoline, garages, building aircraft equipment, airports, etc., all of these things have used this particular material. So very pervasive use. throughout our modern society. Dichloroethene, simply two chlorines with hydrogens occupying the other two positions. And then finally, the fourth in the series, vinyl chloride. Both of these compounds widely used in both plastics manufacturing and photographic development. In that case, we've got one chlorine with the rest of the positions occupied by hydrogen. So again, an abundant series of sources for these, both in urban and rural settings. These are in pervasive use in our modern society. So there's a wide variety of different places where this stuff can get spilled, not just in the initial place where it's manufactured, but in all the large-scale and small-scale outlets at which it's used in our society. And the key point is, once again, this material is soluble in groundwater. Now, it's somewhat less soluble than the aromatic hydrocarbons. Typically, one sees it in groundwater at concentrations of parts per million or parts per billion. But the point is that, again, many of these are known carcinogens and mutagens, and the drinking water limits for these are on the order of just a couple of parts per billion. So even if they're present in groundwater at only 10 parts per billion, that's usually still very significant with respect to their potential impact on human health and the environment. So they're still very problematic, even once they're dissolved into the groundwater system. Again, we'll just focus on one major property of them, which again, I focus on because it has an important implication with respect to where we find them in the environment, and that is the density. These are referred to as DNAPLs, or dense non-aqueous phase liquids, and being more dense than water, then they have a very different distribution than the aromatic hydrocarbons. So again, to just look at that very simplified schematic of a typical groundwater system, if in pink here what we represent is a spill of DNAPL rather than a spill of LNAPL, so you can see it has quite a different distribution. Because it is more dense than water, if that material spilled, it rapidly penetrates the water table and moves quite deeply within groundwater systems. Essentially, it is likely to go as deep as the point where it hits some other heterogeneous unit that has a very different hydraulic conductivity than the unit above it. So typically here in southern Ontario, what might happen is this thing might travel until it hits some sort of clay lens and then pool out over top of those clay lenses. The other important point to note is that it tends to follow very small fractures and microfractures in the system. So the distribution of this material, once it's spilt, is not only deep, but also a very complex interfingering distribution throughout the subsurface, and one that can be very difficult to map. So digging this stuff out is extraordinarily difficult because it's really quite difficult to constrain exactly where it's gone. Again, the story doesn't end there. This is just the distribution of the chemical itself in the pure phase that gets spilled. The key point is then that as groundwater moves past these systems, because they are soluble, you get the formation of these dissolved plumes moving off down gradient from the site of the original spill. Again, the concentrations in these plumes may only be 10 parts per million or part per billion, but still these are very significant with respect to human health. So sometimes when people think about environmental pollution, they may have heard the key phrase that used to get used called sort of dilution is the solution. And that expressed in a natty little phrase the idea that groundwater might actually help contamination by simply diluting it out into the environment where it would do less damage. Now that is true for some compounds, but it's absolutely not true for these types of hydrocarbons. Even the very low concentrations at which they are present in the dissolved plumes has a very significant potential impact on human health and the environment. So really in these cases, what groundwater flow is doing is it is taking a small volume of contaminated soil and creating a much larger volume of contaminated subsurface, and then also carrying that material much farther away into the environment, far away from the site of the original spill. So these are the particular challenges then that we're faced with when we're taking a look at contaminant hydrogeology relevant to those two particular types of compounds. And what I hope to convince you with that rather extended introduction is both the pervasive nature of the contamination related to these compounds in both urban and rural settings, and the importance of them. And these are the ones we selected because of both of those two aspects of their importance for environmental geochemistry. But what we do here at University of Toronto then is specialize in this area of stable isotopes and develop applications of stable isotopes to these particular problems of contaminant hydrogeology. What we're measuring then when we apply this particular type of analysis is we're measuring the naturally occurring stable isotope signatures in these compounds. So for a carbon-bearing compound, the element carbon has two naturally occurring stable isotopes, carbon-13 and carbon-12. And really what we're measuring then is simply the ratio of the heavy to light isotope. So for carbon then, we're measuring the carbon-13 to carbon-12 ratio in a given sample. That then gets normalized with respect to an international standard to derive what's called a delta C13 value in units of per mil. And throughout the rest of today's talk, then, what we'll be talking about are values of delta C13. But remember, really, what all we're talking about here really is it expresses the ratio of the heavy to light isotope, be it for carbon or for hydrogen, which also has two naturally occurring stable isotopes. We're, again, just expressing the heavy versus the light isotope ratio in that compound. And the reason that we measure these is that they provide us with two very important types of information. The first is information about source, because we found over the years that different sources of these contaminants can retain distinct delta C13 and deuterium signatures that then allow us to use stable isotopes to source fingerprint or to differentiate between different sources of contamination at a site where there may have been multiple series of contamination. And in fact, that's very often the case. You're rarely looking at just one spill. You're usually looking at a history of spills, sometimes over decades, with different sources and different responsible parties. Now, in the interest of time, I'm not actually going to spend a lot of time talking about the source fingerprinting applications today. Instead, I'm going to focus more on the issue of biodegradation of these compounds. Because over the last 10 to 15 years, it's been found that, in fact, many microbial populations present in the subsurface are quite capable of consuming these contaminants, and therefore, if they can be used properly, can be used as a means of biodegrading or potentially cleaning up this type of contamination. So really what we're focusing on here is the fact that in addition to giving us information about source, stable isotopes can give us information about chemical processes and reactions such as biodegradation. And that's because, as we'll see in a few minutes, processes like this can fractionate or change isotopic signatures. In other words, change the C13 to C12 ratio. But what we found is it does it in very characteristic and recognizable patterns. So we're able to use those patterns to give us information about whether biodegradation is taking place at all, and in some cases, about the mechanisms by which that biodegradation is occurring. But before we could go on and look at biodegradation, in the first few years of this research, really what we had to do first is take a look at all the various subsurface processes that act on these compounds once they are spilled and entered the subsurface. So to sort of very quickly try to summarize about 2 years' worth of work in one slide, the key take-home point is these other processes that we've been looking at and talked about a little bit, dissolution, volatilization, adsorption, and transport of these compounds, what we found is that all of these processes that are basically processes of physical dispersal or phase change essentially have no isotopic fractionation associated with them. So in other words, they're isotopically conservative. In contrast, the only processes that we found that involve significant fractionation or change in that isotopic signature are those processes that involve actual breakage of bonds. In other words, actual transformation of those contaminants to something else. So degradation, then, is the category of processes that are fractionating. And that is something that we can really use. Pardon me? Actually, you'll notice I dropped it out there. Actually, it is both any process that breaks the bond. So this is true for both physical or abiotic degradation processes and for biodegradation. But in the subsurface, the rates of most of physical processes of degradation are very slow. So in the field, the most important processes that are taken advantage of are bioprocesses, unless it's a very engineered site. So I have a whole other talk that we do on the whole processes of physical degradation. But thank you, because that does highlight it exactly. The issue is any process of degradation where there's breakage of bonds gives us fractionation. But for today, I'll focus primarily on the biodegradation issues, but we're able to use these same techniques to take a look at physical processes of cleanup as well. In biodegradation, I'm trying to illustrate the principle behind this fractionation by this schematic. If you want to visualize this as your plume of dissolved perchloroethylene, so in this particular case, then a plume of dissolved dry cleaning fluid, again, what we're measuring is the ratio of that heavy to light isotope. So I've just illustrated that by indicating the heavy isotope C13 in orange and the light isotopes in green. Again, we're measuring the ratio of those two. what we find is that during biodegradation, or degradation in general, there's a preferential rate of reaction for the light or carbon-12 containing compounds. And it simply comes down to energetics. It's energetically more favorable to break a compound containing the light isotope than it is to break a compound containing the heavy isotope. So during processes of degradation, both types degrade, but we get a preferential rate of reaction for the light isotopes. So you get a preferential transfer of light isotopes into the breakdown products. So after a process such as biodegradation has taken place for some time, we not only see that the total mass of contaminant has decreased, we've had a decrease in concentration, but there's also been a substantial fractionation or shift in that C13 to C12 ratio. The remaining contaminant becomes progressively isotopically rich in the heavy isotope, again, just due to that preferential incorporation of carbon-12 into the breakdown products. And this is manifested by a less and less negative delta C13 signature. So that's just the principle that we've derived in schematic form. This is actually some of the data used to come up with that. What this represents is a laboratory study that we do, or the field does quite routinely. It's something called a microcosm study, whereby you create a model aquifer in the laboratory. So we have a glass vessel in which there is soil, groundwater, and some of the microbial consortia that we know are capable of degrading these compounds. In this particular case, we're looking at anaerobic biodegradation of PCE. And what we do then is we recreate the spill in the lab by putting an aliquot of the contaminant of interest into this system and then monitoring the degradation. What we're monitoring here is we're looking on the y-axis at the delta C13 signature of that PCE. At the beginning of the experiment, it's got a value of about minus 31 per mil, and then we're monitoring the change in the isotopic signature of that PCE as biodegradation proceeds and the fraction of PCE remaining gets smaller and smaller due to biodegradation. So it starts out at about minus 30 per mil, and as biodegradation proceeds, we do indeed see that characteristic isotopic enrichment trend, a less and less negative delta C13 signature in the remaining PCE due to that preferential incorporation of carbon-12 into the breakdown products. Just to give you another example, this one was done for trichloroethylene, or TCE, again, starting out at the beginning of the experiment with a value of about minus 31 per mil, and then as biodegradation proceeds, again, we see that less and less negative isotopic signature, again, reflecting preferential incorporation of carbon-12 into the breakdown products of the reaction. The magnitude of fractionation is very large. This is an order of 10 to 15 per mil change, and that's a very substantial change in isotopic signature. Another couple of important points to note, because these are now we've found to be characteristic features of biodegradation of a wide variety of different compounds, but we first identified them for TCE. The fractionation is not only significant, but highly reproducible. The error bars for both measurements are smaller than the plotted points. And most importantly, each of the points that you see represented there is a different independent experiment, independent microcosm. And yet you see that we have great reproducibility here for two experiments that were stopped at the same extent of biodegradation. We see about the same change in delta C13.
How do you control the biodegradation?
Well, it's a natural process, but it's something that degrades it. So in this particular case, we're taking advantage of microbes in the soil that we know from microbiologists are capable of making that reaction take place.
And so presumably you're not controlling how many microbes are in the soil, because you're saying that no matter what specimen you take, you get about the same.
The rates of biodegradation vary considerably. And I'm skipping out that part, but it was a very important part of what we did. Initially, we thought we would see differences in the amount of fractionation with the rate. But in fact, we found that most of this was largely rate independent, which was quite a surprise. See, now the other thing that's a surprise is this white line here. You know, and the graduate student that did this work will recall calling me to tell me what he found here, and I started leaping up and down. What this is a fit of the data to a model referred to as a Raleigh distillation model, which is basically one of your simplest first-order models of isotopic fractionation, is simply described by this reaction. And as you can see, that data fits beautifully to that particular model. The R-squared on the fit of that data to the model is about 0.95 for this particular experiment. And we found that time and time again, biodegradation of a wide variety of different compounds, in fact, fits this model. What it's telling us is that the amount of fractionation is constant throughout biodegradation, and again, constant regardless of rate, which is a real surprise in a natural system. In a natural system, frankly, we expected to see much more variability. But in fact, what we're seeing is this very consistent behavior with a constant amount of fractionation, regardless of the extent of fractionation and regardless of the rate of fractionation. But the key point is that it allows us then to relate the amount of change in the concentration of the contaminant to the amount of fractionation. When we take a look at materials such as benzene, again, to just give you an example from one of the aromatic hydrocarbons, we see something very similar. In this case, the delta C13 signature of the benzene started out at about minus 27 per mil, but basically we see the same pattern as fractionation proceeds. As biodegradation proceeds and the fraction of benzene remaining becomes smaller and smaller, we see the same type of significant change, and again, an isotopic enrichment in the remaining benzene, again, reflecting that preferential incorporation of carbon-12 into the breakdown products. But there is something different here, and this is why I chose this particular slide, and that is the overall amount of fractionation associated with a compound like benzene. You'll notice you can suddenly see the error bars here. That's not because our error bars got larger, it's because the scale on the y-axis is much smaller in this particular plot. And that's a key point here. For chlorinated hydrocarbons, we see really substantial carbon isotope fractionation on the order of anywhere from 10 to 100 per mil. For aromatic hydrocarbons, we see much less. It's still a very significant fractionation, but this is about the biggest you're ever going to see. That's about 5 to 6 per mil. So it's an order of magnitude at least less than what we see for the chlorinated hydrocarbons. So whereas it's still resolvable, for things like toluene, it's even smaller. It might be 2 to 4 per mil. And these were small enough that they encouraged us for the aromatic hydrocarbons to move beyond just looking at carbon isotopes, but to also look at the isotopic fractionation associated with the other major element that forms the backbone of these chemicals, and that is the hydrogen isotope signature. I don't have a lot of time in today's talk to tell you much about our work in hydrogen, although it's a whole spectrum of what we're doing in the laboratory, but I did want to include one slide just to give you an idea of the significance of that kind of work. Again, this is exactly the same experiment, but in this case we're monitoring not carbon but hydrogen isotopes. The delta deuterium value of that benzene started out at about minus 70 per mil, and then as biodegradation proceeds and the fraction of benzene remaining becomes smaller and smaller, we see exactly the same type of classic isotopic enrichment trend. So again, reflecting that preferential incorporation, in this case, of H1 into the breakdown products. But what's really extraordinary about this is you can see we start out at about a value of minus 70, and at the end of the experiment we have values of plus 70 per mil. These types of values hadn't been seen before in a natural system. The overall range of fractionation here of about 150 per mil is one of the largest isotopic signatures that had ever been identified in these types of systems. So what that's telling us is that we have a very, very large and therefore very sensitive signature of biodegradation coming from the hydrogen isotopes. So for compounds like the aromatic hydrocarbons, where the amount of carbon isotope fractionation is small, we will often combine that information with what we can get from the hydrogen isotopes, because the two together provide us with a much more definitive and sensitive indicator of the extent of biodegradation. Okay, so having given you an idea of where we're going with that,
is that something peculiar to this particular degradation of this particular compound?
No, as I say, these are now things. I'm showing you one example of each. But we're now finding that this kind of thing is characteristic of a wide variety of different environmental compounds. The magnitude of the fractionation comes down to a little bit, comes down a lot to the structure of the molecule and which bonds get broken as it biodegrades. So if you've got a compound where biodegradation does not involve breaking of a hydrogen bond, then you're not going to see this kind of very, very large effect. So it does come down to the details of the chemistry explaining how much fractionation we see in what situation. I have a whole other talk on the details of the chemistry, but I didn't integrate it today. Why had they not been seen before? No, it had not been observed in environmental geochemistry, basically. The reason for that is a new type, the instrumentation that I showed you there is a new type of technology that allows us, you remember in the title I referred to this as compound-specific isotope analysis? Until 10 years ago, we couldn't measure the isotopic signature just on benzene, for instance. We could measure the isotopic signature of dissolved carbon in groundwater. And what we now know, and we would observe variation that was maybe on the order of 10 per mil. What we now know is what we were looking at there was a very, very averaged out signature. We weren't seeing the big ranges because we were looking at the entire pool with the fractionation of all kinds of compounds all mixed together and flattening each other out. The reason these had never been seen before is because this is some of the first work that ever measured the isotopic signatures on the compounds themselves, the individual compounds, benzene separate from toluene, separate from ethylbenzene, etc. Okay, great. So where are we going with all this then? And why is it important? We've developed now an understanding of fractionation in these systems. I've just given you a smattering from a couple of different examples, but the principles that I've laid out for you we are finding are consistent for a wide variety of different organic contaminants when they undergo biodegradation. Where we're going with this is that over the last 10 to 15 years, biodegradation has really come onto the radar screen in terms of both the public and the regulatory agencies as a potential means for cleaning up sites. 20 years ago, the idea was whatever you had to do, it had to be a highly engineered system. It had to be dug up, cleaned out, extracted, taken away. They started to realize that A, that was very expensive, and B, with things like DNAPLs, impossible. If you've got DNAPL penetrating the system to 100 feet, just how much of that ground can you excavate and get that stuff out of there? So there's been a shift over the last 10 to 15 years in contaminant hydrogeology that coincided with a recognition from the work of by our colleagues in microbiology that in the natural environment there are many, many microbes that are capable of degrading these compounds. So the idea is, can we take advantage of that as a means for cleanup? So really what's been happening, this was driven, as I said, over the last 10 years largely in the U.S. initially and then followed in Canada, was this idea of harnessing biodegradation as a potential means for cleaning up sites. Now, the current protocol, which has been established by the US EPA, involves the accumulation of a very broad basis of evidence if you're going to prove to them that this is taking place at your site. You need evidence from microbiology, from chemistry, from field experiments, from modeling. The key point is there's a very, very high burden of proof involved here, and rightly so. Because the problem is if you take a look at a site and measure decreasing concentrations of contaminant, you can get decreasing concentrations of contaminant due to all kinds of other dilution processes. As we've seen, transport alone, dissolution, volatilization, adsorption, all of these things can cause the concentrations of contaminants to go down at a given point. But that doesn't necessarily mean that contamination has been cleaned up in any way. It may just have been spread out further into the environment. So decreasing concentrations of the contaminant alone cannot be taken by the regulatory agency as definitive evidence that cleanup's taking place. So what we're asking ourselves is now that we've developed this understanding of the very sensitive indicators stable isotopes provide us with for looking at biodegradation, can we use stable isotopes to provide a more direct indicator that when concentrations are decreasing at a site, they're decreasing because of actual transformation to more benign end products, and not due to simply dilution of the material out into the environment. So that's kind of a practical driver for this research. So again, just to summarize then, that's because degradation in general, but biodegradation in particular in this talk, provides us with this progressive isotopic enrichment in the remaining contaminant, these less and less negative delta C13 to deuterium values. Since this is degradation are the only processes that produce this effect, as we now know from several years' worth of laboratory work, then we can use these isotopic signatures to distinguish between mass loss that's due to this strongly fractionating process, due to what's now known to be non-fractionating processes of contaminant dispersal. So it really is filling a very key niche in terms of providing a very dramatic indicator of the effects of biodegradation. Now, I wanted to show you a bit of a field application of this today, and of the various sites that we've worked at, I decided to focus once again on one that's related to chlorinated ethenes. To do that, though, I had to tell you a little bit more about these compounds. These are the ones I introduced earlier, the dry cleaning fluid, degreasing agents, etc. And when I talked about them earlier, I pointed out that each of these can be spilled at a site, and you can have each of these present at a site due to primary contamination, due to a truckload of this falling over or a pipeline of vinyl chloride bursting. But what I didn't let you know is that, in fact, these compounds are also related to each other in a reaction chain. One of the key means by which naturally occurring microorganisms, degrade these materials is by a process referred to as reductive dechlorination. And that's a stepwise replacement of chlorine with a hydrogen atom. So, for instance, when microbes attack perchloroethylene, what they do is to cleave off a single chlorine and add a hydrogen and form trichloroethylene as the first degradation product. Trichloroethylene can then be attacked with cleavage of another chlorine and addition of a hydrogen to form cis, and similarly all the way down to formation of the first non-toxic and benign end product. So you may have a site where the only thing that was spilled initially was perchloroethylene, but you may have all of these other compounds there if you've got microbial degradation taking place, because they can be produced from this one by this degradation chain. Yeah. No, it actually probably forms HCl, hydrochloric acid, which is a very weak, dilute acid, so it goes into the water. And you can actually monitor this process sometimes by measuring the chlorine content of the water, because it will go up slightly. Usually the mass balance is such that it usually doesn't have a major acidification effect in the groundwater, but it has a major acidification effect in our analytical instruments, I'll tell you. But yeah, it's HCl that it comes out in, which sounds worse than it is. It's actually fairly dilute acid. So these are linked in a biodegradation series then. Earlier, what I showed you with the isotopic fractionations associated with degradation of PCE as a primary contaminant, TCE as a primary contaminant. Clearly, what we've done is also measured the isotopic fractionation associated with these compounds when they are linked in that kind of reaction series. And that's what I want to show you now. So we're starting out first again with one of these microcosm experiments done in the laboratory. No isotope data on this slide. What we're looking at here is just monitoring the concentration of these various compounds as biodegradation proceeds in this direction over time. Again, what we're doing here is we're adding only, in this case, TCE. I could have shown you a similar experiment for PCE, but again, the thing to bear in mind here is we are spiking this experiment only with TCE. But again, it's in a system, a microcosm system, a model aquifer in which we have soil, groundwater, and microorganisms from that soil that are known to reductively dechlorinate. And what we're monitoring then is the decreasing concentrations of TCE due to microbial degradation in yellow. We see formation of the first daughter product, cis dichloroethylene. We can then monitor the cis rising as the TCE degrades, and then eventually the cis itself peaks and its concentrations go down as it itself is being degraded to the next less chlorinated compound. And then finally the vinyl chloride goes away and we have production just of ethene, and in this particular experiment, complete mass balance with complete transformation of the chlorinated ethene that had initially been added to the non-toxic end product. So I want to show you now the isotopic fractionation signatures that are associated with this. So on y-axis here now, we're just looking at not concentrations, but the delta C13 signature for each of these individual compounds in different colors. Again, biodegradation is proceeding in this direction. The TCE data is nothing new. This is what I showed you before. It starts out at about minus 32 per mil, and as biodegradation is proceeding, we're seeing that now classic and hopefully familiar isotopic enrichment trend. In other words, a less and less negative delta C13 signature in the remaining TCE due to that preferential incorporation of carbon-12 into the breakdown product. But now you don't have to take my word for it. You can see what's happening in that breakdown product. The cis TCE that's initially being formed is much more negative than the TCE from which it's being produced. Again, that's reflecting. That's where the carbon-12 is going. That's what's producing that very negative signature. But then as the cis TCE itself is being degraded to the next compound, it too undergoes that classic isotopic enrichment trend as it too is being biodegraded, and again we get preferential incorporation of carbon-12 into the next step in the chain. So similarly for vinyl chloride and ethene, the initial product that's formed is very depleted, and then we see each of them undergoing these isotopic enrichment trends as they themselves are biodegraded. Yes?
Would it be fair to conclude that the if you went for a long time, the limit of the
absolutely, and thankfully it is in this particular experiment. Precisely. Actually, this experiment runs out to about 4,000 hours, but just to focus on the early time period, I don't have it all here, but fortunately it does. That we may the ethene eventually, unless it itself degrades, the ethene eventually, yes, the end signature of the ethene is identical to the beginning signature of the TCE. So you get complete compositional and mass balance, and isotopic mass balance within the microcosm. In the field, of course, our chances of getting that complete mass balance are nil due to transport issues. So we don't see that in the field, but within the microcosms, that's exactly what we see. So breakdown products, initially more negative than the compounds from which they form. We do see that often in the lab, where we're able to sample whenever we want. In the field, we often miss that early stage. But the products subsequently show these same isotopic enrichment trends as they themselves degrade to the next chlorinated compound. So what it means is that we can use information from both the parent and the daughter products to get information about biodegradation. And that's good news in the sense that we've now got an additional and very sensitive means of evaluating biodegradation. But frankly, I would have been a little disappointed if all we'd done is added yet another potential line of evidence for the EPA to require people to come up with. Although useful, that's not necessarily a net good thing in terms of looking at the economics of this type of application. So really, we were looking to see whether there was any added value that this isotopes provide us with. Was there some way that this particular technique could provide us with information that could not be got at using the more conventional protocol of monitoring the concentrations of those breakdown products? And that's what I want to talk about here. In fact, we have been able to find that there's significant added value, particularly in identifying the very early stages of biodegradation. And that's the case study that I'll be talking about here, the use of isotopes to provide us with sort of an early warning system, a first means of determining is biodegradation taking place in this site or is it not. So to do that, I'm going to go back to this data one last time. And I'll just do it very quickly, but this is the same data you saw before. I just want to focus on these very early time periods. Again, this is the microcosm experiment where we're looking at the concentrations of chlorinated ethenes. And what I want to point out here is really from a regulatory perspective, the points in this system where you'd first have any luck walking into your EPA regulator and saying, we think we've got biodegradation. The first indication of biodegradation, as we've discussed, can't be decreasing concentrations of your primary contaminant. There's just too many other processes that could just involve dispersal of that material into the environment. So you're going to get nowhere just saying, oh, look, the concentration of our contaminants is going away. The first point where you might get somewhere would be this point here, which in the microcosm experiment took place at about 10 hours, where we got the first blip of our first breakdown product appearing above detection limit on our analytical equipment. But even then, you're not going to go running to the EPA because you've gotten one blip on one time period of your first degradation product. Really, the earliest that you could begin to breathe a sigh of relief at all and be sure that this experiment was going properly might be out here at about 25 hours, where not only do you have the appearance of both cis-DCE and a rising trend of that cis-DCE, but you've also got the appearance of the second breakdown product, final chloride. So maybe about there you start to breathe a sigh of relief. And this is where the isotopes become important. If we take a look at that same time period, you can see that by 10 hours, we've already got a very significant isotopic shift in the delta C13 signature of that TCE. And in particular, by the time you're out at 25 hours, which would be the very earliest that you'd be able to stick your neck out and say, based on concentration data, that biodegradation is taking place, by then, it's abundantly clear from the changes in the stable isotopes that you do successfully have biodegradation taking place in this system. Yes. Oh, again, the error bars on, we're scrupulous about error bars. If you don't see them, it's because they're smaller than the symbols throughout here. It's a very good point. It's a function of detection limits. Yeah. So, again, remember here we're actually plotting apples and oranges. This data I could probably take off here entirely. The reason it only pops up here is this is when it reached the point that we could analyze it on the isotope instrument.
Yes.
On the other one, it pops up at the point at which it can be measured on a gas chromatograph. So it's those different things reflect the different detection limits on the two different instruments, but it's a very good point. Yes?
Well,
It all depends. It depends on the field site, because rates of biodegradation vary enormously. But no, we never make just sort of the immediate assumption that the rates in the lab are equal to the rates in the field. They're not. So we did this work to try to understand the systematics. And then the next step, okay, in the lab, obviously, we do have this window of opportunity. We can clearly see evidence of biodegradation from looking at the isotopic signature of the parent compound before we could make the same interpretation based on the appearance of the breakdown products. But given the vagaries of always trying to extrapolate laboratory data to the field, you put a PhD student on that. So anyway, Penny has just finished this work and will be defending very shortly. But that was exactly what she needed to do, was to then take what had been identified as a potential window of opportunity in the lab and see if, once we went to the field where you've got differences in rates, differences in transport, no ability to have a self-contained system where you're going to have mass balance control. What else can we add? Oh, yeah, no control on necessarily when you're going to get the samples, because the EPA regulators don't necessarily send you as many as you'd like. Can this still be a useful approach? So really that was the objective, was to see whether that window of opportunity identified in the lab could be successfully utilized at a field site, and a major component of Penny's PhD. So the site that she's working at is Kelly Air Force Base in Texas. This particular site, the source is well constrained. It's a number of leaking storage tanks full of perchloroethylene located up a gradient of the major building at the site. So these tanks were leaking. Groundwater flow was in this direction, so you had movement of that PCE plume across the site, and Penny's site is located in a pilot test area in the courtyard of the building. So just in words then, PCE is the primary contaminant spilt from waste tanks located to the west of the pilot test area. But although PCE was what was spilt, background monitoring at the site did show evidence of both trichloroethylene and cis-dichloroethylene. So this told us that it probably was us. We actually were not involved in it at this point. This told the EPA and the Air Force that they had a site where there was probably some potential for in situ reductive dechlorination. In other words, some of the microorganisms native to the site could break down this material. And indeed, that's not uncommon. The presence of microbes that can reductively dechlorinate these compounds and consume them, at least as far as cis-DCE, is quite common. The problem we find now, having done surveys in the natural environment over many years, is they're beginning to find that although there are many, many microorganisms that can take this process this far, you're really only getting out of the frying pan and into the fire. Cis-dichloroethene is still a very nasty contaminant, and transforming PCE to this one is of questionable use. But at many, many sites, that's what gets seen. If there is degradation at all, it stalls out at this point. There are several sites, though, and obviously they've become the subject of intense study, where natural, non-pathogenic consortia, such as this one, KB1, have been identified that are capable of taking that process all the way through to the benign, non-toxic end products. So again, a number of sites, they've identified this kind of microbial consortia. The one we've been doing a lot of work with is actually from Kitchener, Ontario, and is referred to as KB1. We're working with it because of our colleague over here in chemical engineering, Elizabeth Edwards, who first cultured this particular organism. And again, the intense interest in it comes out because it is indeed capable of pushing this system all the way through to what you might actually call cleanup. What's being done by Dr. Edwards and a number of other researchers worldwide is they're looking at a process called bioaugmentation, where you take this naturally occurring organism. So again, it's not genetically modified, nothing's been done to it. They're just taking it from one site where it exists and putting it in another site where it would appear that it doesn't exist, and seeing if they can get it to then take reductive dechlorination to completion at this new site. And they do that by a circulation system. Again, this is a small-scale pilot test at the site. If it's successful, they want to apply it to the whole site. But what they do then is they inject that microorganism consortia into the groundwater and then pump it through the system to recirculate it. And then they're monitoring the concentrations along the groundwater flow path to see whether they are achieving complete reductive dechlorination. The concentrations then, this is data provided to us by Dr. Edwards. Again, this is the initial conditions at the site. I mentioned to you that the spill was perchloroethylene. but they clearly had evidence of both TCE and cyst-TCE at the site. And this is the evidence that led them to suspect that the natural microorganisms were doing some degree of degradation. And you can see that right here. The largest concentration is not PERC. Perchloroethylene at the beginning is already down here. TCE is about comparable concentrations, but they had very high levels of cyst dichloroethane. And this situation had been monitored over several months. Basically, it was not going any further than that transformation of what had been a PCE spill into a cyst dichloroethylene plume. On day 192, then, they bioaugmented and added this additional microbial consortium called KB1. And then over time, what they saw was a rapid decrease in the PCE for the first time, an initial increase in TCE, and then the TCE itself died away. The cyst bounced around for a bit, but then did indeed start to decrease quite significantly, and then finally they see the rise in vinyl chloride, and by the end of the experiment, something fairly similar to what we saw in the microcosms, a rising trend of just the concentrations of the non-toxic end product. And this was quite consistent throughout the pilot test area. So based on this, they were quite content that what they were seeing was indeed a success story, that they believed the Air Force was quite keen that they had managed to successfully bioaugment this thing through to complete cleanup. But the reason they brought us in was because they were very much concerned with the cost. That little recirculation system that I showed you actually cost tens of thousands of dollars a day to keep going. Pumping this stuff in, recirculating it, monitoring it, paying the cost of everybody doing the monitoring is a very expensive proposition. And every day that a system like that is running is costing them money. So managers are standing around with bated breath trying to figure out whether or not that system's working or not. If it eventually works, great, but if you're just pouring tens of thousands of dollars a day down a black hole because this isn't actually working, you want to know when to make that call. So the timing, again, becomes a particularly important issue. Got a lot of people standing around trying to see whether this thing is working. And so again here, just as we did in the microcosm, I want to point out to you, personal sense, exactly when we were able to make a decision that in fact it looked like the system was working well. Now, our site manager is a very optimistic kind of guy, and he stood up at a conference on day 209. Day 209 is the day that we first saw the first blip of vinyl chloride above detection limits on the GC. So in other words, the very first and wildly overly optimistic point at which you might declare the program a success. Dave stood up at a public meeting and declared based on that one data point that this entire project was a success, causing most of the other people in the room to almost go into a dead faint. Now, fortunately, his optimism was rewarded, but it was not done so for about another 40 days. Basically, we have the first blip of vinyl chloride here, but it was really only out here at about day 50 where you have not just a rising trend of vinyl chloride, but a rising trend of ethane that anybody else was willing to really agree that this thing was working properly and that we were probably in good shape. So we've got basically a time period here where a lot of people's reputation are on the line and a lot of money is going into the ground when they're trying to figure out whether or not they can actually declare this whole thing a success and keep it running forward. The isotope data that I'll show you is very consistent for the site. We did the work at five different wells over the same time period, but I'll just show you one because they were quite consistent. We didn't receive quite as many samples as we would have liked to, but the fact is it still shows exactly what we were looking for. In this case, we're monitoring the delta C13 signature, again, of each of these various compounds. The initial delta C13 signature of PCE at the site was about minus 30 per mil. As you can see here, by about day 209, that PCE is already up at about minus 21 per mil. And between 192 and 209, we've got an clear isotopic enrichment trend ranging from minus 21 to minus 18 per mil. So the PCE seemed to show an isotopic enrichment trend. After that point, the PCE dropped below concentrations that we could measure, but we could still continue to measure the isotopic signatures on the breakdown products. TCE, as we would expect from a breakdown product, is much more depleted than the PCE from which it's produced. Similarly for the cyst-TCE, and then in the late stages of the experiment over time, we see the same type of isotopic enrichment trend in the cyst-dichloroethylene and in the vinyl chloride, consistent with biodegradation. So the overall patterns of change and the relative isotopic signatures between these various compounds were completely consistent with what we would expect from the laboratory. But again, the key point was understanding this issue of timing. What point could we make the call that this system was working well and biodegradation was really taking off at this site based on the isotope data compared to conventional protocol? So again, on this slide then, I've just plotted the PCE data and then compared it to the conventional protocol, which is based on looking for VC and ethane. And as you can see here, as I mentioned, between day 192 and day 209, we already have a very significant isotopic enrichment in PCE. So essentially from the isotopes, we could have made that call around day 209. For vinyl chloride, again, the very earliest, if you'd want to call that, is about day 30. And in fact, the very earliest that most people were comfortable with is out here at about day 252. I'll just put dates on all of that because I think it gives you a better intuitive feeling for it. Bioaugmentation began on May 5th. By June 5th, just a month later, the delta C13 values for the PCE had already shifted from minus 21 about to minus 18. And as you've seen, we know of no process other than biodegradation that can produce this kind of isotopic enrichment. But significant concentrations of vinyl chloride and ethene did not appear until mid-July, if you were Dave, and most of us were not too comfortable with that announcement, but really early August before we could make the same claim using the conventional EPA protocol. So what we feel then is that stable isotopes give us the potential to really add significant added value, particularly in terms of identifying the early stages of biodegradation, and that monitoring the delta C13 values of perchloroethylene or TCE can provide us with evidence of biodegradation of these primary contaminants prior to the point at which we can make the same call based on conventional EPA protocol. So then just to quickly conclude, again, a very significant fractionation that's been able to be identified when one looks at the isotopic signatures of these specific compounds, something that could not be identified 10 years ago. We find that this compound-specific isotope analysis then can help us verify mass loss due to degradation and distinguish that from mass loss due to some of these processes that simply involve dispersion of the contaminants into the environment. Significant added value compared to conventional protocols for identifying biodegradation to regulators and, frankly, to the public as well. And again, as I mentioned at the beginning, the future research directions here really are now trying to take this technique from a more qualitative type of observational science into more of a quantification approach. And the key to that are indeed these Raleigh models. The fact that these follow this very consistent Raleigh fractionation means that there is the potential to then try and quantify both the extent of biodegradation and rates of biodegradation and start to incorporate this data into some of the work our colleagues are doing on reactive transport and modeling of groundwater systems. So I'll close there, and if there are any other questions, I'd be happy to entertain them. Yeah. Yeah, it's a... It's an excellent question. I mean, I've mentioned...